The Guardian. Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. A recovery for all is the pledge from Ed Miliband, who says it's the only way to combat what he calls a wonga economy. But is the living wage the right way to do it? Also this week, is Britain really the best place to live in the world? A new report by the OECD says so. Maybe that's why our population is set to grow by 10 million by 2040. Plus, Conservative MPs are being asked for their input on the next manifesto as David Cameron puts his election strategist on a full-time contract. The big society takes a back seat, but what will be the next big idea at Tory HQ? Joining me for all of this, we've got the Observer's political editor, Toby Helm, its economics editor, Heather Stewart, and the contributing editor of Conservative Home, Andrew Jimson. A warm welcome to you all. Now, with the cost of living firmly established as the political battleground, Ed Miliband used a speech this week to announce a new policy encouraging firms to pay not just the minimum wage, which currently stands at £6.31 an hour, but the living wage, which is currently £7.65 nationally and £8.80 in London. Critics on the right immediately warned that such meddling would lead to a rise in unemployment. Heather, you're the economist at the table. What's the point in a living wage if there's really no guarantee that anyone gets it?
Well, this is one of those, well, David Cameron would probably call it a nudge, but this is one of those ways government can, they don't have a lever they can use to insist that everyone pays them the living wage. And in fact, a lot of economists fear that that would be a bad thing to do. It might lose people jobs in certain industries
if you set it too high.
And Labour was extremely careful when it set the minimum wage not to set it too high in such a way that it would lose people jobs. However, this is something that government can do to exercise kind of moral suasion, as it were, a little bit more than that, to try and persuade more employers to do this. And there is some evidence, actually, that in certain industries it can help productivity, it can reduce staff turnover, and it can have kind of benefits outside the sort of social benefits. And, you know, Ed Miliband also thinks he'll get quite a lot back in terms of increased income tax and reduced tax credits. So it's a different approach from the government subsidising low-wage employers, which is what they did on quite a large scale, you know, through the tax credit system.
Oh, I see. But there's still, I mean, the particular policy thing was something about the company would get tax back for a year or so.
Yes, it's a short term, which is why I was sort of calling it more of a symbolic nudge, I suspect, than something that will necessarily, you know, send employers rushing to do this. But
and I suppose it relies on the fact once you've given someone that pay increase, it's quite tricky then
to take it back away again. Yeah.
So, think worth trying?
Yeah, I think it is worth trying, and I think it's bang in this area of you know, he gave quite a solid speech earlier in the week, Miliband, and he talked about the fact that the problem at the moment seems to be that the link between economic growth and living standards has been broken. And I think that's quite a strong argument for them. You know, they can't now shout, where's this recovery? We haven't got a recovery. It's been clobbered by the government. But they can say there is a recovery and people can't feel it. And that's because something's gone wrong in the way, in the share of growth that ordinary workers take home. And that's a kind of long-term trend, but it will really ring true with ordinary people, I think, who will feel, you know, things might be looking better according to some of the data, but it doesn't feel like that to me. I mean, it feeds very, very directly into this sort of cost of living argument.
Andrew, one fan of this living wage thing is Boris Johnson, isn't it?
Well, Boris certainly doesn't believe in grinding the faces of the poor. He's a Merry England Conservative and he wants everyone to have a good time, and he knows you can't if you are desperately hard up. So I think a lot of conservatives actually agree that there is this problem visible in America as well of people whose incomes have actually shrunk and who have no progression within whatever work it is that they're doing, which is necessary work, but is very, very badly paid. It is a serious problem, and I think Miliband deserves some credit for trying to think of an answer.
But Heather, what would you say to the idea that there isn't really such a thing as the cost of living is an issue that's distinct from the economy? I mean, in the end, it's how much money the economy is churning out and our ability to
buy
the
stuff. Well, but the cost of living is a way of putting it across to ordinary people who are sitting there, you know, watching, as you say, their real wages stagnating or even falling over a long period of time. You know, PwC put out a report this morning that suggested it'll be 2017, I think they said, before real wages, you know, inflation adjusted wages, will be back to where they were before the crisis. I mean, you know, these people will be feeling that the kind of basic bargain that you strike with the government or with the capitalist system, or if you're being grand or whatever you want to call it, has just failed. Their standard of living has not improved. So, there, you know, and I think that idea that the linkage between generating economic growth and generating higher living standards for ordinary people has been broken, I think that's quite a strong argument to make at this point. And as you say, it's not just a UK problem, it's something that's happening more widely.
It's certainly set the mood music, hasn't it, at PMQs and just in Parliament generally now, week in, week out for a long time.
Well, what Ed Miliband's done quite cleverly is he created an argument from his conference onwards in Brighton about the cost of living, energy crisis, energy companies charging too much, with some idea of how to tackle that. And then he goes to the other end of the argument through the living wage, which is about your wages. So you have the costs and then what comes into your family budget. And it's a kind of argument, I think, that connects with people, and it connects with the kind of people he needs to motivate within the Labour Party as the first stage to getting himself projected more aggressively to the electorate. I think it's working as a strategy because it's simple and it makes sense.
Do you think, I mean, for years on this podcast now that we've talked about opinion polls and things that talk about Ed Miliband as a drag on Labour, you know, people might be ready to turn back to Labour, but there's been a lot of disobliging things said about him by the punters, but do you think that time's over?
I think he's not Tony Blair in terms of presentation. He's not David Cameron in terms of presentation. But he thinks deeply. He's a likeable person. He comes across well. And I think, you know, I think actually low expectations of Ed Miliband plays quite well for Ed Miliband. The closer you get to an election and people have fairly low expectations of him, don't really know him, but are beginning to get to know him, are beginning to get interested, that works quite well for him.
What do you think, Andrew?
Well, I think the Tories would make a great mistake if they think they can win the election because Miliband's hopeless.
But that's what some of them have said.
Some of them do think that. If they thought they could win last time because Gordon Brown was hopeless, well, people will make up their own minds about Brown and Miliband. And I know quite a lot of people who intend to vote Labour, even though they don't have the very highest opinion of, you know, the present Labour leader. And they certainly don't want to be told by the Tories. What they want to be told by the Tories is how they'll do better. Which the Tories conspicuously failed to do enough of in 2010. And they mustn't. I mean, if Linton Crosby gets them going on this attack dog stuff, it won't do them any good at all, I don't think.
We'll come back to Linton in a minute, but just on Ed Miliband, do you think that there's something that changed with what at the time looked quite messy, that manoeuvring around Syria and defeating the government? It made him suddenly look like someone who could get things done.
Well, you sound like a man who wants to believe in Miliband. I think he's still got problems on that front. Even if people approve of his fuel price freeze, many of them enormously or very much doubt or don't really believe that it would actually work or that he'd actually do it. So he still has severe problems with credibility, and all his trouble with the Unite Trade Union is again a problem of a continuing lack of authority even within his own ranks.
Good point on Unite, isn't it? It's still looking messy after one, was it two investigations that both went in and said it's all okay, Heather?
It's just the sort of thing you would hope that a strong leader would be able to clear up very decisively, and it's still rolling on, and there are still stories in the paper about it every day, and the INEOS dispute was a, you know, complete disaster for Unite. It really doesn't look good.
Unite and cost of living and everything else will rumble on as ever at theguardian.com, I should say, /politics. But now we've become so used to bad news when it comes to global league tables that this week produced something of a surprise. Obesity, binge drinking, inequality, UK is usually lurking at the wrong end. But this week it was named as the best place to live and work by the OECD. Heather, you've had a look at some of these numbers. Are there reasons to be cheerful, or is it completely arbitrary?
Well, I think it's quite interesting that it wasn't really based on asking us. It was mostly based on objective assessments of things like wealth per capita, income per capita, you know, the size of our houses, the amount we have to spend on various things, life expectancy, all kinds of, you know, great mix of things. And we're not the best country in the world, but we come in the top band, along with, ironically, a lot of those countries that people always say that they might be longing to, you know, retire to, say, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the sort of places that people say they're going to migrate to for a better quality of life. But apparently, if you look at it objectively, we're not quite as badly off as we might think we are.
Do you think there's something in the culture that just means we're never going to believe it? We did an online poll, Toby, on The Guardian, which by 2-1 said people said this was rubbish and that Britain wasn't a good place to live. Is that The Guardian readers?
We kind of revel in that, though, don't we, really?
I mean, it's such an enormous question, isn't it? It depends what you ask and what you're referring to, really. But I don't know, both me and Andrew have lived in working for our different newspapers, and, you know, you pick something from the German way of life that you love. You pick something from the Belgian way of life, which I love living in Brussels. And you could pick a million things from the British way of life. I think you find your level and you find your enjoyment. And you, as long as you're reasonably prosperous, you can enjoy living in most places.
You'd be happy anywhere. Everywhere
I would be happy anywhere. I'd be happy in anywhere as long as it wasn't at war or riven by appalling...
Even if they didn't play cricket, that would be conflict. I suppose you watch some cricket on the telly.
Yes, we still watch the BBC in Brussels.
An awful lot of people do come to live here, even particularly in London, which is fantastically expensive. But, you know, lots of people from France and Germany and all over the place actually want to live here, which must mean that they see something attractive about conditions here.
And both well-off and people searching for a job want to come here. So we are a magnet.
Part of the reason why we've got these projections of population going up again by another 10 million, Heather.
Yes, it's partly to do with migration, and it's partly to do with you know, migrants who come here over recent years, you know, continuing to have families and larger families and so on.
I think what is really interesting, actually, and I think perhaps what it tells you partly is that I think our multicultural society works far, far better. We're far further down that process than most other European countries.
Although, do you think? I mean,
and I think that makes us a magnet. That makes us feel quite good
London,
about ourselves.
I mean, not in the same way in Dewsbury or
no, not in the same way. But I think we're still ahead of our, you know, the equivalent of Dewsbury in Germany, which might be some city in East Germany, what former East Germany. You know, it will be more. It'll be further down that line, I think, further down the road towards, you know, understanding what living with other cultures is about.
Do you agree with that, Andrew?
I think I probably do. I went to Angela Merkel's constituency the other day, and the main town there, which is a place called Grimmen, the population has shrunk from 15,000 to 10,000, actually, which means there's rather a depressed feeling in Grimmen because the most active people have gone off to work in Hamburg or somewhere. So, I think it's certainly easy to see what's wrong with one's own country. And then you look at the Germans and think, oh, they're so rich, they're so successful, they have such beautiful motor cars, and miss the fact
they're
that
they're not great at integrating. I suppose
they're not
Berlin
great at
is,
integrating. Not
Berlin
great, no.
There's a big Berlin cultural element, but they tend to live in sectors, don't they?
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
And actually, the size of people's sort of friendship networks was one of the things that the OECD, one of the many things that the OECD looked at in this report, and, you know, sort of community atmosphere and those kinds of things.
But both that, Andrew, and as Heather says, it wasn't the only bit of this report, but a little bit of it was about asking people how cheery they feel, basically. The kind of thing that David Cameron was very keen to raise as some big issues in opposition, wasn't he? He used to say general well-being. It should be GWB and not GDP.
Yes.
Do you think when the GDP disappears, then we lose interest in that? Or do you think he still likes that kind of...
I think he still likes that kind of thing, but in a recession, it starts to seem a bit of a luxury to talk about it as a politician.
Well, let's just turn now to... the Conservatives and how they may or may not have changed, because this week the election guru Linton Crosby, who's from Australia, has been signed up for £500,000 a year between now and the election, and his brief essentially to keep Cameron in number 10 and ideally dislodge the Lib Dems from the government for good measure. Now, Linton Crosby, are we right in saying he probably isn't the sort of chap that Cameron Mark 1 would have wheeled in?
It would have been a surprise, wouldn't it? On the other hand, Linton did run Boris's two campaigns in London, and he understood what kind of a person Boris was, and he he actually forced Boris to stop telling jokes for several months, which was quite a struggle. And it was very annoying. If you were a journalist who knew Boris, which obviously many, since he's himself a journalist, many of us did, it was actually became pretty much impossible to get to him. So Linton imposed a very tedious discipline, but it was extremely effective. And he didn't actually try to make Boris into a different person. He just tried to make him more professional. So,
He sort of got a British profile, didn't he, after very hardline anti-immigration campaigns in Australia and then Michael Howard's campaign. Some people were uneasy about not racist to talk about immigration. I mean, do you see the appointment as indicating that there will be more emphasis on, say, immigration, or do you think he'll work with the marching orders that he's got?
I don't know. I had a little tutorial from Linton when I went to interview him. I mean, he said I can't do the Australian accent, but he said you have to lock in the base and then go for the swing. And I think the first bit of locking in the base is being tough on things like immigration and dealing a bit with UKIP and all that. Then you do your liberal stuff after that.
So is it possible that we'd see something like the Big Society being tacked on in I don't know, spring 2015?
Exceptionally unlikely, I would have thought. It just didn't fly, did it? I mean, it didn't work. That invitation to the people of Britain, the manifesto last time, just was unsaleable on the doorstep. No one really understood what it said.
And Toby, it's reported this week that there's an implicit recognition of the fact that the kind of rather flashy manifesto, which was launched in Battersea Power Station a few years ago, hadn't worked. And this time there was the revolutionary idea of asking the backbenchers whether they might like to chip in.
Yeah, I think one has to be quite sceptical about that. Certainly there's a lot of restiveness among Tory backbenchers, I mean, to a really remarkable degree, actually, about the extent to which they are not talked to by the centre. And particularly if you bear in mind that David Cameron, after the expenses scandal in 2008, said, I want to open up politics to real people, doctors, nurses, lawyers, etc., etc. He got the likes of Sarah Wollaston and people in, and they're now furious that they're not listened to. So, I mean, the fact of the matter is that the Tory backbenchers are an incredibly diverse group. You know, they go from, you know, fairly right-wing and potty to very, very soft left, and left of quite a lot of the Liberal Democrats. And to listen to that group, I don't know what you would come out of it with, to be honest.
I mean, I think this is a question of party management. They're to be given
getting the news story out.
Well, a lot of them are underemployed.
Exactly. You have to be seen.
There are fewer jobs around because, of course, the Lib Dems have got a lot of the jobs. If you're a reasonably bright Tory man, there are a lot of other reasonably bright Tory men in the 2010 intake, and very few of them are going to get into government in this. So then you think, well, at least I could have some bright ideas. And so this is. I'm afraid I think it's window dressing. Really, it's listening. Yes, okay, we'll listen to your bright ideas, and they'll all be fed in via Joe Johnson and Oliver Letwin. But in the end, I'm quite sure that George Osborne and Cameron will control the manifesto and will damn well make sure that any idea from a backbench which they think is idiotic is completely suppressed.
So remember that 2005, I think it was, when Lyndon Crosby was running the Tory election campaign, they boiled it down to about three messages.
Oh, yes, Cameron did that, didn't he?
And one of which was something else I can't remember.
That's it. I think it may have been six messages.
It was not a particularly wide-ranging manifesto.
Memorable, though,
yes,
clearly.
Yes,
I just linked that to the Lyndon Crosby point, but anyway.
Yeah. I mean, traditionally when backbench Conservatives, all the voluntary party is asked what it would like to see more of, Heather, it said tax cuts. And Tim Montgomery, who's our friend who's been on this podcast before, is writing that today. But they've got to walk a bit of a tightrope on tax cuts, haven't they? Because they've also got austerity forever. I mean, have they got some room to do something on taxes before the election?
Well, it'll be very interesting to see the extent to which. So we've had a couple of quarters of very strong growth. It'll be very interesting to see whether that persists into the new year and whether it brings in the improvement in tax revenues that is hoped for. So at the moment, the economy is growing more quickly than the Office for Budget Responsibility is expecting. Tax revenues it'll be modest, but they'll be a little bit higher than expected. It's just about possible that there might be a little bit of room for manoeuvre for not necessarily something hugely generous, but something, you know, some kind of token lollipops in the run-up to the election. But it would sit within the framework of, you know, this is an austerity programme that will have to continue for another 5 years. But of course, that would be, it would be a very Tory way of attacking this kind of cost of living crisis. It would be, we'll put, you know, never mind this living wage nonsense, we'll just give you more of your own money to spend, put some, you know, put some money back in your pocket. It would be, you know, you, it's another way of attacking, in a way, that, that same problem.
Do you remember the conference just gone? George Osborne said, we're not just going to go for a balanced budget, we're going to go for surplus, we're going to go on with austerity, you know, in political terms, forever, you know, right through to the end of the decade. Isn't there a danger of mixed messages? The Tory party might like tax cuts, but the public then might be confused about how iron or not this Chancellor is.
Yeah, I think you have to be pretty careful with that, yeah. But he could, as Heather, I think, says, you make the point that these tax cuts are putting more money in your pocket, so the actual aim is to generate economic activity, which creates more tax revenues, which helps you bring the deficit down. It's a kind of classic virtuous circle.
And what do you think, Andrew? I mean, obviously lots of the party would like it, but would George Osborne be very worried about looking like he was doing what Ed Balls had told him for all that time?
Oh, I don't think he'd be all that worried about that.
Well, they wouldn't do a VAT cut, would they? Wouldn't have thought, no. Which is Balls has chosen.
No, I don't think. I think they have such contempt for Balls, they won't. They just don't think anyone can really think they're doing what Balls tells them to do. But he won't want to look unscrupulous. I think the original plan was to have all these, you know, have the spending cuts at the beginning of the Parliament and the tax cuts at the end, obviously. And that plan got blown very badly off course, partly because there was always this sort of rhetoric about very severe cuts. And in fact, although there were severe cuts in some areas, overall there weren't severe cuts. We're still borrowing colossal. I mean, Heather can probably understand these sums of money. I certainly can't. They're much too big.
I don't think anybody can.
Having said that, Osborne is capable of being pretty damn brazen, isn't he? I mean,
yes.
If you look at I know that the Green agenda wasn't his particularly, but the way he kind of just threw that overboard unceremoniously, I can see maybe him being a bit braver than we think he would be, or maybe
ought
to be.
Doesn't have to be huge either. It can just be a kind of symbolic
gesture.
Because
he's a smart politician and he understands the cynicism of politics.
He'll promise more to come, won't he? And then, of course, will Labour match this? So, you know, he'll pose a difficult... Whatever he does, it'll pose a difficult question, an unanswerable question.
Slightly bigger than we think.
So you think he'll gamble?
I wouldn't be surprised. I just think it's within his... I think it's in his nature.
We think of the inheritance tax launched
exactly.
When his back was against...
Precisely.
But how... I mean, the one defining thing and the one thing where he's... like made great efforts to stand up against a large part of the party was on saying he doesn't believe this argument about tax cuts paying for growth, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
And do you think he'd be worried about sort of wriggling off an argument that he'd been on for so long?
I don't think he'd be worried about that. I think the basic Tory problem is that people think they're a party for the rich, and Osborne and Cameron haven't really worked out how to deal with that. But I imagine in the manifesto they will, I hate the expression hardworking families, but they'll be trying to show that they're doing something for ordinary people who, you know, have led less privileged lives than they've
led
themselves.
One of the very few handouts they have given is the increase in the personal allowance, which is very much...
Under Lib Dem sort of prompting,
indeed,
yes.
Pushed by the Lib Dems, but that they do sell that. When you talk to the Treasury, they do sell that as kind of, here's one of the things we're doing to help low-paid workers with the cost of living.
Yeah. I suppose, Heather, they'd have a big argument with the Lib Dems if they said, let's cut the basic rate by a penny or whatever, rather than increase the allowance, isn't it? Because that's all in the manifesto.
Yes, about how targeted it is and, yeah.
And... do you think this marriage tax proposal that always... I mean, there's still a plan to have a showdown and a vote on that at some point, isn't there? With the Lib Dems might vote against, I think.
Well, I think that's very popular with the sort of Tory rank and file.
And that was quite targeted.
And that does mean a lot to Cameron, actually, but not really to Osborne. Osborne is some sort of liberal. He doesn't believe in these old-fashioned things like marriage. So.
But do you think that could be the... You know, if they soup that up a bit, could that be the most eye-catching giveaway for the election?
I'd be surprised. I think that'll be rather token, actually. I think it'll be something else.
Is that more aimed at the backbenchers than the public, that one?
Well, I think it is a kind of gesture politics. It's a gesture which means a lot to Cameron, I think. But
I think where... Don't get me going on marriage tax allowance, by the way. But I think where the tax action might...
No.
My God,
the
Toby.
The tax action might happen is on businesses and small businesses, I think. And I think that's maybe where Cameron will be aiming. I think Miliband very much wants to, because he's been attacking big business,
yes,
corporate interest, he will be really looking for ways, he already has done to some extent, of making it, making appeals to small business, yep, through the tax system. Cameron will have to counter that. It's going to be a lot about business this election, I think. Small business, how we get it working. The big argument about the Europe, business in Europe, European referendum, I think that's where the tax action might happen.
Do you think, I mean, we know that Ed Miliband says, Heather, that he'd like to, he'd tolerate not cutting tax on big business in order to reduce rates, as they used to be lower, didn't they, for small businesses. Do you think the public will buy that, or do you think really they think it's the big companies that generate the wealth?
No, I think the people are quite sceptical of big business, and you know, it's always a persuade this is a tax rise, but, you know, they have cuts in the corporation tax rate for big businesses, you know, going forward 2 or 3 years. And what Labour said it would do is cancel that and spend the money on struggling small businesses. You know, the other side of the argument is you only pay corporation tax when you make a profit, whereas you have to pay your business rates. If you're a little struggling shop or something, you've got to pay your business rates come what may. So actually, if you go around and talk to small businesses, it's often those business rates that they squeal about. So I think it makes a lot of sense. I think, you know, voters who are running little businesses, that will kind of resonate with them, I would have thought. And I don't sense there's a great deal of sympathy among the public for big business.
But when you talk to economics people rather than politics people, do they say, oh, this, you know, all this about dragging productivity and in the end of these low wages as well? Is that, might that be because there are too many small businesses?
Well, that's never going to be an argument that's going to resonate with Labour, is it? What we need is a kind of purge of, you know, all these terribly inefficient small businesses that should have gone out of business. There is an argument of that. There's about that. There's an argument that the banks, that one of the results of what's happened in the banking sector is that we've had fewer write-offs than we would have had. We've had fewer, extend and pretend is the kind of phrase in the banking industry, that there are a lot of businesses out there, that zombie businesses that are being kind of kept afloat by banks that have been, you know, encouraged really not to call in loans. And so, yeah, you could argue there are some uneconomic businesses out there that should be purged, but I'm not sure that's a terribly popular argument with the man on the street, to be honest.
Andrew, I wonder, the tax dodging argument about the Amazons and the Googles and everything that got some real traction in the last year or two, whereas business tax always used to be you know, a completely peripheral issue in politics. If there were to be further tax cuts on corporation tax, where George Osborne's already made them, do you think there'd be a danger that that might backfire politically in the same way that cutting the 50p rate of tax for rich individuals did? Or do you think it would still be seen as something that was a bit peripheral to...
I think it could backfire, yes, because it's back to this business of being on the side of the rich and not on the side of these, particularly in this case, on the side of rootless international corporations which have no loyalty whatever to this country. I think they've got to be extremely careful about that. And they'll be much more keen to support small business than definitely.
Well, that's all we have time for. My thanks to Toby Helm, to Heather Stewart and to Andrew Jimson. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.